Thank you for listening to Casualty Friday on the Fangoria Podcast Network. I'm Felissa Rose, and before we get into this episode, I want to tell you all about Fangoria Magazine. Fangoria Magazine is better than ever. Each issue includes set visits from the newest movies, both the blockbusters and the indies, deep dives into your favorite flicks from all decades, and of course, the signature insight that you've come to expect from the world's best horror and cult film magazine. Subscribe today and get a new Fangoria sent straight to your door every 3 months. And once you finally open up that envelope, you'll also find that Fangoria is now a beautiful, deluxe, 100-page deep dive into horror. You'll never find these articles online. It's print only, just like the good old days. Go to Fangoria.com and use the promo code FRIDAY for 15% off your first year of Fango. That's Fangoria.com. And I want to tell you all about our friends at Diabolik DVD. For over 15 years, Diabolik DVD has been the source for horror, cult, and weird cinema to customers all over the world. Diabolik offers a one-stop shopping experience for all of your favorite labels, including Arrow, Synapse, Vinegar Syndrome, Severin, Mondo Macabro, Blue Underground, 88, and many more from all corners of the globe. Whether you're looking for the definitive version of Suspiria or trying to upgrade your crusty old DVD of Cannibal Holocaust, Diabolik is the owner-operated small business choice for all of the demented discs you've been craving. Browse the shop at DiabolikDVD.com.
Fangoria presents Casualty Friday.
Thank God it's Casualty Friday. Welcome back to your home for horrific beginnings, endings, and all of the junk in between. We're your hosts.
Kane Hodder.
And Felissa Rose.
And I'm Tiffany Shepis. And today we have a crazy, crazy episode. We have one of our favorite friends, filmmakers, awesome human beings in the house. Somebody that has directed all of us, been in movies with all of us, been friend to all of us. Mr. Adam Green.
Yay!
We love you so much.
I love you too. Thank you for having me.
Oh my God. Adam is like one of our first guests we're having here on Casualty Friday. And it makes perfect sense since, I mean, all of us were in a Hatchet film together. All of us have been on Scary Sleepover. But we're not just here for that. We want to discuss directors. Direct This is the title of this episode. So first of all, what's the first ever? The fastest way you can tell us this, the first thing you've ever directed.
The first thing I ever directed was a series of short horror movies called Stone Cold Crazy. And my uncle had one of those, I don't know if you remember these video cameras. They had like the mini tapes that you would put them inside a VHS tape and it stretched it out so you could play it in your VCR. And he didn't know what to do with his camera. And so I didn't really know what I was doing, but I would just kind of chase my friends around with my hand out in front of the lens, like the hand was killing people. And all it would do is it would run up to people and then we would cut because I couldn't edit. You had to edit in camera. And then they would like take off all their clothes and leave their clothes on the ground. And then you would just jump cut to now they're gone and their clothes are there. It was so stupid.
So
we would show them at parties and then everyone just wanted to be in them and see themselves. But that was, I guess,
how
the first thing.
How old were you?
14 probably.
14. So kind of at the same time we made our first movies. We all could have been making this garbage together.
I would have been doing it at like 6, but nobody had a video camera. So when my uncle got
one. Is
that
when you felt the excitement and the want and the passion to be a director?
8. When I saw E.T. the second time. Because the first time.
It made you want to be a director.
Yes, because the first time I was just absolutely blown away. But then we were only allowed to go to the movies twice every summer. And we couldn't get popcorn. My mom would bring sandwiches in her bag, and it was always tuna fish. And it's
she's
like,
Felissa. Felissa brings sandwiches to everything.
You gotta bring something that smells like this, you know. And all the other kids have popcorn, but we were poor. So anyway, the second time she's like, "What movie do you want to see?" I'm like, "I want to see E.T. again." And she's like, "You already saw it." I'm like, "I have to see it again." And the second time, I just wound up analyzing it because I knew it wasn't real. E.T. didn't even look real. But yet I was uncontrollably crying at the end. And I'm like, how did they do this? And so I started noticing the music and I started noticing the script. And I like, and then
But what do you guys think that is with Spielberg stuff? Because you hear that all the time with like directors like E.T., Jaws, like that these were the movies that made them say,
this is what I want to do. Do you think it's just the way it's such a, like a fluid storytelling, like the characters, like that they're human?
I mean, he's the greatest of all time because he taps into such a real emotional thing, no matter how fantastical the story is. And it just, he also has all the resources, which does help a lot. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you have John Williams scoring your stuff, like literally John Williams could score this podcast and people would be crying. Like it's just, it's
people cry during our podcast, regardless.
I'm always,
there's a very emotional podcast. So yes. Yeah, they're very yawning emotional. And the tears come down.
But you know what, Adam, dying. I have to say you do the same, your storytelling and the way you direct us. And we can all say that because we've been your actors. You are the same exact way.
Oh, I'm maybe not the same.
No, exact. You are. Are you set?
You are an exact incredible twin of Steven Spielberg, Adam. It's you.
I'm
it's
sure
like
he would appreciate hearing that.
This is what he's on a podcast going.
I'd like him to call in right now.
Steven, we have him on the phone.
Call us.
Please give us a call.
Okay. Now, I mean, so speaking of that, though, like that's like your first experience. Steven Spielberg, like, holy crap, I want to make movies. Was there any filmmaker that or director that you saw that was like, that was terrible? I don't know if I want to be involved in this.
That's a really good question.
Something you've never been asked, I bet.
Yeah,
for real.
Because, well, especially at that age, I think, and sadly, it's kind of still true today, I kind of like everything I see. Like, this is going to come off weird, but hear me out. When you go to a screening of a movie in, like, the Midwest, for instance, everyone is there to like the movie in... On the East Coast, on the West Coast, it's not like that.
There's a lot of hate.
Yeah, the movie better prove itself. It better like they go in with something against it almost.
Right,
and
to criticize.
Well, do you guys think that just because all of us out here know so many filmmakers ourselves and everybody wants to be in it, that it's always a judging thing, no matter what?
It's business. It's the mecca. I mean, New York and LA are the places where we do primarily make the movies. So it's immediately it's through that lens. But, oh, I could have done that. I want to do that.
But with that line of thought, shouldn't it be the other way? Because we all know how hard it is to get anything made. And it's a miracle that it actually got shot. And we know how hard it was. We know they never had enough resources. They didn't have time, that everybody is doing the best they can. So why wouldn't you go into it applauding the fact that it exists? So I try to find the good in most everything. Although for the last couple of years, I just fall asleep.
I generally try to find the good in most everything. And I used to be a big cheerleader about stuff because I've certainly, we all know, have made a lot of pieces of garbage. And I used to be like, but I was great. So there's one positive. But now I've gotten to the point where I'm like, it's not that hard to put something together. You may not have the resources. You may not have all the money. But like just a quality, all right, at least it was shot well. At least you had different, you know, decent actors. I don't think that's that difficult.
I would disagree.
I would completely disagree.
Yeah,
oh,
because if you don't have time and money, you have everything working against you. So even the most basic thing, like, for instance, why is it that everything always has to be shot at the wrong time? Like you have to be cheating day for night, or you have to be pretending there's a door there. Like you can't just shoot where something is supposed to take place when it's supposed to take place. Always.
Weather. You're usually filming. It's supposed to be snow, but it's hot as shit. It's all those elements that
make things difficult. Are difficult. I'm not saying it's not hard. I'm saying that if you start, everything starts with like a script, right? I mean, you're great script. Mm-hmm. And if your script is really fucking solid, it's really hard to make it awful.
And that's where everything either has a chance or goes wrong, is with the script. It is really hard. It's really hard to write a script, but it's next to impossible to write a really good one. And so many people are just so proud when they get to the end that they think it's ready, or they can't take notes or criticism, or because they haven't had enough work that they wrote made, they don't know how to foresee what's not going to translate well or make sense. So there really is no excuse for a script to suck, because that you don't need money and stuff.
But
unless
you're
being rushed.
But you have an eye for like editing and like a background in that stuff too. So I think that really helps, like that you should know how to complete something from script to the end, right? And you should be able to foresee how it's going to be cut together.
I think everybody who works on a film should at least know the basics of every other position, because it's only going to make you stronger. Like as an actor, you should know the basics, at least of editing, because if you don't, it's one thing to hit your mark and do things the same way because they told you. But if in your head you're seeing why the camera is where it is and how this is going to come together, it's only going to help you give a better performance. As a director, I try to always explain that. Like, for instance, whenever we're doing a kill and hatchet, I always tell you exactly what the shots are and how it's going to go.
So you know, yeah.
So it helps, I think.
A question for you guys that'll come back to you. What if you had your mecca pick of directors, and I don't mean person to person, I mean just what exactly would you look for that you would say, this is what the true leader of a set is? Because I think it's different for everybody. Like, if you want the approach of that they're going to come at you. An actor's standpoint, do you want to know how the script is played out? Like, assertive, let you do what you want to do. What?
Well, certainly someone who's talented just in that the script is incredible. I've read their scripts. I've seen their films. Someone like Adam. But I feel like someone who's also kind and giving. And that's because the trust has to be so incredible between the two of you. The relationship has to be so strong so that especially we as horror actors have to feel safe. That's the ultimate goal. And that's how I felt with you on the set. I felt so safe. I could do anything. Like, it was you made it feel like it was a playground and we could all jump and utilize what we had and make it the best, you know? So that's what I feel. There has to be a certain relationship between us.
From my point of view, you know, once I became known in the horror business a little bit, I noticed directors very often either trying to direct me too much and I'm not even sure why, maybe an insecurity thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I know how to play a murdering psychopath, and they'd either try to direct me way too much. You know, I don't mind some input, or do nothing. And that's why somebody like you was perfect, because when we did the first Hatchet movie, you weren't real experienced in film of that size at the time.
But he was making the mini tape movies.
Right.
but yeah, I'd only really done shorts.
Because it's your character, not mine yet. It's your character. So you did the perfect balance of input to the character, but also letting me try to create some stuff too. And it almost never happens that way. It's almost always one way or the other. And it gets frustrating. I wish more directors were confident, but open to hearing things like you are.
Well, to go back to what you said about the directors who either over-direct and micromanage or the ones who won't say anything, I think both of those issues are the same problem, which is just that they are nervous and intimidated.
Sure.
So the over-direction comes from a place of wanting to try to prove to you that they know what they're doing.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
And then the ones who don't say anything are probably afraid to say anything.
And I hate that.
Yeah.
And they're just
you shouldn't be a direct, be a producer if that's where, because you can go whisper it to someone else. And
see, I always get the problem because like I'll come get brought onto a project and like maybe they knew me from before or were intro to me, and I talk a lot and like I make a lot of stupid jokes, and I generally have like one interesting idea for their thing, and then they'll look at me and go, well, if you want, just add your own thing to that. And I'm like, whoa, I'm not a writer. You know, it's like, I don't want to have to be burdened with, all right, all of a sudden now I have to figure out what my character is. And now I have to write a witty line. Like, you know, so it's like,
expecting be funny. You to say be something like funny here.
Improv-y when it doesn't, it's not supposed to have that. And then I'm like, all right, now I'm uncomfortable. I'm weirded out. And it's like, I want a fucking director. We don't have to actually be friends. We don't have to have a relationship for me. I actually just want somebody who really knows their script and is married to it. And it can explain to me why I'm doing this and this.
And do you feel that a director directing their own written material is better? Always?
I think so.
I think it's better.
I would think so too.
Because
I don't know.
They know the motivation.
Material. Right. Of course.
You know, they understand. They wrote it. They understand why somebody went from A to B. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was going to ask you, is that when you started directing, like, and you were doing just stuff at home with kids, and then you started doing it professionally, did you have to figure out your directing style, like what kind of director you were going to be, or was that just this is how I am.
I bet that was natural.
Yeah, it was very natural. And then oftentimes, especially on the first Hatchet movie, something that I would do, I would hear from crew members who were far more experienced and had made more movies than I had. They would tell me, oh, that's just like this director or this person. Like, one of my things is that you got to remember, and especially when you're making your first one, it's not hard to remember, but you're so lucky that you're getting to do this. And all of these people are there and giving you everything they can. They're never getting paid enough, but they're there for you. And so there was one night where it just started raining and pouring rain. And we weren't prepared for it. I certainly wasn't. And I think Will and I were wearing trash bags over ourselves. And I just would not go into the producer's tent until it stopped raining. If the crew had to be in the rain, then I was going to stand in the rain with them. Or like frozen. I never went to a heater or anything. I stayed there. The actors were trapped on a chair.
Well, that's 50 feet a terrifying job for those actors.
Right. Like, so because they couldn't go to the bathroom, I wouldn't go to the bathroom. If they couldn't eat, I wouldn't eat. So that if you're going to ask somebody to do something, then you better be willing to do it yourself, save for stunts and lighting yourself on fire, because that I can't do. But
we're going to try it here today, though.
But one of the producers, the only one that we never worked with again, kept saying, like, you can't get sick. Come into the tent. And I'm like, I'm not coming into the tent. And he just made such a big deal out of it. And I'm like, why are you turning it into a thing? Just stop. But I think when your crew sees that you're in it with them, like, I usually don't go to Video Village. I don't know if I've ever sat in a director's chair before. I'm always standing by the camera. But
then that's probably why they were willing and happy for you to come into the warming tent, not get sick, because they're like, all right, our leader's not a douchebag. He actually cares about us. He's not overworking us for the sake of his movie. It is our movie, you know?
And that's the thing. You have to make it just as important as it is to you to everybody else. And to go back a little bit, comfortability is everything for actors. And that's why every director should act in something. And you don't need to necessarily be good, but just do it so you know what it's like. One of the techniques that I do in rehearsal, and feel free to steal this if you want, is there's always a night.
Wait, like, we had a rehearsal on Hatchet?
Well, no, I don't rehearse on features. I have meetings and lots of conversations, mm-hmm. but especially, I've been so fortunate that the actors I'm working with, 99% of the time, they're really experienced. So I don't need to sit and have them prove that they know their lines or something. Sure. Like, I know they're going to do the work. So it's more just a conversation so that we don't need to stop and have that conversation on set where suddenly we're not on the same page or they don't understand what the joke is or something like that. But one of the things I do, like on Holliston, is that once we have the lines down, and that's different because it's more like theater, and we rehearse for months before we get to stage, and then we can shoot 32 pages, I think was our biggest day, although we did that on Victor Crowley too. Crazy. But one of the things I do is we all switch characters. And
that's cool.
There's no reason to really do that because I'm never going to play Laura. Joe's never going to play Corey. But by doing it, it shows you afterwards, you realize what you need to give that part because you're hearing the lines that you're going to say being delivered to you. And we always come out swinging so hard after the night that we do that. And it seems ridiculous while you're doing it. And you laugh a lot and it's silly, but it does teach you what the other actor in the scene needs from you. So
that's amazing.
Is that a technique that,
it's just you something I made up. No,
really? That's cool. Amazing.
But yeah. That brought me to, I wanted to ask you, because you worked on Holliston. Mm-hmm. How was it working with Adam from purely a director standpoint on like Hatchet and Frozen to now director actor Adam? Because that's a totally different deal mm-hmm. to like different direct yourself. Because like, did Joe direct you or did you just direct?
I just directed myself. Although I do have Sean Becker there who on season one, Sean's, I think his title was I don't know, it was some sort of producer credit. Mm-hmm. But the hardest part of that is, on set for a sitcom, the director's mainly in charge of just getting the coverage and making sure that everything is shot correctly. Mm-hmm. And so on season one, after we would roll, I'd have to run back and at least check something from each camera.
But
and that
for
wastes
you,
time.
Like, how was it watching him do those dual hats? Like, is it
I didn't
different?
Have to do it as much on.
No, well, not really. I mean, it didn't seem like it was noticeable at all, really.
And remember, like, Halston's not about shots. It's like the C camera, which is the middle one, is always just a wide. And then you know which ones are going to get everybody's close up. And unless there's like a special moment, like a physical gag or something, it's so straightforward. In fact, that was the hardest thing in making season one was, for lack of a better term, dumbing it down. Where, you know, naturally you're like, well, let's add some camera movement here. You don't do that on a sitcom. Mm-hmm. I thought that it was going to be weirder for these seasoned actors to be. I didn't know if they would treat myself or Joe seriously as actors, because they hadn't seen us really. They'd seen like the Fright Fest shorts and things. And remember, too, we're also playing versions of ourselves, mm-hmm. which, to go back to what I was getting to before, it's just about being comfortable. If you're comfortable, mm-hmm. that's the biggest hurdle to get past. Anybody can memorize lines or whatever, but if you're truly comfortable and you're not nervous that the camera's on you, or then you can almost do anything.
I was wondering from you guys on the actor side, because we've all know how it was to work with Adam, which was great. Mm-hmm. Has there been a situation with a director that was so off-putting that it made you uncomfortable? And I don't mean in like a physical way, like, oh, mm-hmm. they're creepy and want to grope you or something, but like the way they directed, the way they weren't prepared made you ill-prepared to be on the set.
Yes. Mm. I was on a set. I had my son with me. So he was about 6 months old, almost, and he's 10 now. So almost 10 years ago, we had to fly up to upstate New York, and we were doing an intense scene. We were in a basement, and my two kids had to kill each other, and I was all tied up, and my husband was dead. He was played by John Philbin. And the director and the gentleman who was playing the killer got into a huge fight, but so severely. They were screaming so loud at one another on the set. We all were asked, we were escorted out. The whole set was disrupted. Oh my God. I mean, he turned.
And let me guess, you never respected the director again after that.
I was terrified to even go back to set. And it turned out that he was a bit crazy and he fired the whole crew. And trying to stick up for them, and then he was getting upset with me. It was so nasty. But I never experienced, nor have I to this day, experienced anything like that. So when a director erupts into this crazy behavior and you don't feel safe and you're completely upset by what just happened in front of you, the film is shit and you feel awful and you want to go home.
Yeah.
So safety is the most important, especially for horror. I had to get my shins sliced and screaming, I'm covered in blood and this is what's happening.
Well, it's funny, like even on like, you know, old school trauma movies with like as silly and crazy as Lloyd Kaufman is, like the number one rule on every one of their sets is safety first, like safety to the human body, safety to people's property, like,
yeah. And be kind. Like,
it's just, that's number one. Like, how do you pass that
like
up?
Like you said, we're all lucky to be there. I just did two movies back to back with Thomas Churchill. He's so nice on set. He's like you, Adam. He's just so nice. He's so gracious. He's always like, thank you, thank you, thank you. And we're all happy to be here and let's go. And that's what it should be like. You know?
I don't get actors that get nasty because, like, I understand you're stressed or whatever, but you're an actor. You can't act nice, like, when you're getting
like, you can't pretend. Yeah.
It's not hard.
But maybe they're not that good. Maybe that's the thing.
Usually, that's what.
But
happens.
I mean,
that's
but
interesting.
Personally, on my sets, I haven't seen that, but I've been very fortunate and unfortunate. Unfortunate that I still have never gotten to make a movie with a budget that I think was even close to what the movie needed. And I don't mean like I need a huge budget to do all these crazy things I want to do. I just mean the bare bones, what was necessary. What we did with Victor Crowley was obscene. That movie never, ever should have even been finished, let alone turned out the way it did. And when, you know, I do a podcast with Lynch on the Fangoria Podcast Network. and through that whole process, because remember we were keeping that film a secret, mm-hmm. and even still, it's only now, I'm doing an interview later today for Australia. It's just coming out in Australia now, 2 years later. Wow. So you never want to disclose your budget because there's no good that comes of it, because once you say what your budget is, that's what people see when they watch it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's true. And it's suddenly true. They think they know. They don't know the difference. Like, but for foreign sales and stuff, they want that information because then they can lowball you. And I would listen to people come in and be like, we only had 24 days or we only had 18 days. And like, you know, we only had $2 million to make that movie. Can you believe that? And I'm sitting there like 11 days, 400 grand, like just... And then they don't believe me when I tell them. I mean, you guys were there, so you saw it. But
don't you think you will always want more? Like, as a director and as a creator, you're always going to be like, if you had a million, you're going to be like, we only had a fucking $1 million. I wanted to have three explosions.
Yeah, but he would not do that.
No, I would not.
I don't think you would ever say, oh, I wish I had more, if you had adequate amount.
Yes, that's all I want. Because remember, if you get more, you're setting yourself up for failure. Because it's my job. Mm-hmm. Above everything else, to make sure that whoever invested that money gets it back and then some. And I've always done that. So the reward, though, has been, holy shit, look how successful that movie was. And he did it for nothing. Let's see what he can do for half that. Not what you think it would be, which is, all right, let's give him a little bit more now. It just doesn't
give you
work
less.
Like that. But where I'm fortunate is that I've been able to keep making my own projects with Arescope, with my people, with my friends, to cast who I want. If the budgets were astronomically bigger, I probably couldn't do that. I would be being told, you have to choose one of these three names because of their value in China and Australia and here and there. Yeah. So...
Which generally deflates your budget anyway, because it's like, if you had 100,000 more, now that person costs 75, and you're like, what, it didn't give you what you wanted anyhow. But I wanted to hear from you, like, Kane, have you worked with somebody that you thought, well, maybe not even shitty, just not in a style that you were used to that affected?
Not really in any horror project, but when I used to just do stunts, there were some giant name directors that would direct some of these huge movies that we would do stunts in. And they would sometimes, one in particular, would presume to tell the stunt people how to do a stunt. And boy, that is the worst thing you can possibly do as a director. You're going to tell me how to do a stunt? No. And one day in particular, I had some words with big name director because he tried to tell me how to do something, and it was regarding fire. So that's even more of a sensitive subject. Don't fucking tell me what to do. And we had some words, and I was not
asked to leave
back the next day.
Well, but you have to fight for what's right in those situations.
But it shouldn't have to be a fight.
Big though, that's
it's your movie.
One.
But fucking let your experts.
Definitely. Well, that's why you hire them.
Yeah.
There's no reason to hire. Like, you wouldn't go to your fucking dentist and be like, "Let me tell you how to do that crown."
Yeah.
You know? Exactly. It just doesn't make any sense.
I'm dealing with something right. Well. I had a little shop of horrors dentist growing up, which is why I've had so many dental problems. The dude would just drill on every child that got in there.
Oh.
And then the parents eventually started talking to each other.
There was a dentist in Florida that apparently got straight up shut down, arrested.
He ran. This guy, he split, changed his name. Like, you can't find him. He overnight he disappeared.
They would not tie the kids up, but essentially say, oh, we have to strap them down for this.
He didn't do that. Ooh. But he just
pull teeth like crazy just for insurance scam. But these poor kids were covered in grills, because
you go in and for a cleaning, and then all of a sudden the drill comes out and you're like, wait, what are you doing? And he's like, oh, I found three, they're really, really small, I'm just gonna take care of them right now so you don't need to come back, it's easy. No Novocaine, no gas. And you're gripping the chair, tears going down your face, you know. I'm like 8-9 years old, and he would just be like, oh, come on, you're a big boy. And then I'd walk out and my mom would be like, wait, what did you do? And he's like, oh no, well, we had time, so we already took care of it. Insurance covers it. You don't need to worry about it. It's all done. And so all my mom would hear is, okay, well, it's taken care of.
Great.
And I didn't have to pay for it. But then 6 months later, oh, two more cavities. And my mom would be like, what are you, not brushing your teeth? Like, I brush my teeth.
I mean, you
clearly
weren't getting candy at the movie theater.
No,
so
I had to eat fucking tuna fish. And eventually all the other kids had the same issue.
Jesus.
And he was doing such a bad job that now as an adult, these fillings he did, any dentist I go to is like, they're always kind of like shocked at first. So I've had to have two teeth
pulled. Did you go to Dr. Payne in Revere, Massachusetts?
This is a great horror movie,
Dr. Robinson.
I love this.
And he wasn't in Revere.
Doctor who?
Robinson. And anyway, but going back to what we were talking about.
What made you the director you are.
Exactly, the dentist. But going back to what we were talking about, and just comfortability, what we're doing essentially, though we're doing it with tools and money and all that other stuff, is we're just playing. That's it. We're making pretend. Mm-hmm. And would you want to make pretend with your friends from the neighborhood, or would you want to go to another neighborhood and play pretend with kids that you don't know? So the fact that I've always been able to bring my friends in and also to write parts specifically to their strengths is really good. And, you know, I don't want you to take this the wrong way. I don't think you can take this the wrong way because it's a compliment. But so many people have said to me that they thought that Victor Crowley was this is to Tiffany, for those of you just listening and not watching, that Victor Crowley was the best they've ever seen you in anything. And,
well, thank you.
But I basically wrote a scene that I have always wanted to see you do, or a character I've wanted to see you do, because you've always played tough, funny, sexy, get killed or whatever. But like to see
in that order
do to see you do drama like that, and and also to have you like pinned down, like you couldn't use your hands, you couldn't do any, like, well, it was only your heart, that was it, and it worked. Mm-hmm. The fact that people cry in a Hatchet movie, I never
thank
thought that
you.
That would
no,
work.
And thank you. And I do take it as a compliment. And it was oddly like, and I've said this before, that, you know, I was really excited when I read it because I was like, oh, wow, it's something different. Like, it's not, I'm not cracking jokes. Like, generally,
I would have thought you would have played
the
my
Kathleen,
character,
like, kind of shit talker, like, crazy. And so I was really excited. And then I got really nervous when I realized I was pinned down, because I've said this to you guys, like, using my hands so much is such a crutch for me. And it's such a part of me and
that's
part
why
of
you did it, you
know? My acting that it was really
for real.
Difficult.
That's why he did it.
And you're like,
he knew you could perform without that.
Oh, they, I don't know. But I do get a lot of people that are like, I actually cried and I sobbed. And I'm like, yeah, because he hates babies and women and he sucks. And that's what we had to have.
No. And then for your character, Felissa, you introduced me to that character during Scary Sleepover when you were talking about the agent that you had.
Oh, that's funny.
And so it was your agent. Like, that was
so
it.
Fun.
So
I love casting.
It's a perfect character.
But even knowing that and trusting that Kane could do emotional stuff and cry, and I just knew. And it's like, especially because when we met, you were at such a turning point in your life. You didn't know what was gonna happen with your career, and your mother had just passed away, and it was just the timing was right for all of it. But when people would ask, "Oh, what did you already seen them do that showed you they could do it?" It's like, well, I just knew they could.
Now, I know we've talked about it on another episode, but just kind of recap us on how that first meeting went when you met Adam for the first time. And he was like, almost fanboy.
We almost BJ's. Met before that, though.
The BJ's, right?
Is that what it was? I think it was called King something. It was a fish place, wasn't it?
Oh, is that where? I was thinking.
Well, tell us it from BJ's. Go ahead. So they don't care. Pick a place. Well, I mean, Church's Chicken.
But I wrote this in the POV.
I like yours.
My foreword to your book, I wrote about how I almost had met you years before at Spooky World, where I was
there.
Spooky World?
Yeah. I went 1 year, the year after that, I guess I went and I met Alice Cooper. And
at the farm, right?
Yes, at the farm. But I waited in the line, and then I don't think you were leaving. It was probably a break or something, but I had to leave. And I was like two people away. And then they, you know, I don't know what was happening. They just suddenly, like a handler or whatever, like kind of walked you out. And everyone started to disperse from the line. And I was like, I just waited this whole time. And like,
and then it started to rain on you. Everybody was sad music.
When the day came that we were going to meet, I was with Corey Neal and Sarah Albert. Sarah, who's produced like everything I've ever done. And I was like, you know, I never got to meet him that time at Spooky World. Maybe it would be cool if I brought some of my Jason stuff for him to sign. And they were so mad. They're like, do not bring stuff for him to sign. Like, you're trying to prove to this guy that you can direct. You've never made a movie before. Don't show up and be a fanboy.
But ironically, it wouldn't have mattered.
No.
It wouldn't have bothered me in the least. And it wouldn't have made me think anything less of your potential. So they were wrong, but they were trying to look out for you.
Yeah, well, he has all his stuff.
I should have brought
right
it today.
So we'd like. And
every time I'm going to see you, I'm like, should I bring it?
Come on. Kane will never turn down the $20 autograph.
No, I'll give Adam 10.
It's a 2-for-1 deal.
That's great.
So, but you, when you met him, though, you said like you saw something in him that was different. But,
I did. Oh, I mean, yeah. It seems.
I mean, I don't want to be like a jerk off fest, but true. Like you said that.
I did. I've met a lot of, you know, people that were saying, you know, I'm going to produce and direct and I wrote this and we're going to make this movie. And I'm always, you know, very open to listening to it. And it hardly ever happens, of course. Mm-hmm. But just, you know, and it just sounds self-serving, but it was totally different talking to him.
It's a different
deal. He was so knowledgeable and focused from a guy that really hadn't directed anything. It was just.
And you think that's probably
done,
because
like,
of your love
a lot of
film.
Shorts and
right,
I had made a feature but no one saw it.
But right. You love but you know movies. Yeah. Like I think the people like that are genuine fans of cinema are going to have a better take than the dude that comes on the scene and is like, well, I kind of like shit. Like,
I love whenever I read fan turned filmmaker Adam Green, and it's like, like, is there a football player who never watched a game before he played? Like, we're all fans; otherwise, you wouldn't
do
it.
There's some filmmakers out there that I've talked to, and some that these guys know too. That like, you'll walk on a set, and they're like, "Well, yeah, I'm making my first horror movie. I'm so excited." And I'm like, well, oh, so you're big, like, you know, watch a lot of horror. No, I did watch The Exorcist once. And you're like, how are you going to jump into a genre and expect to make something that's new and different if you've not seen even the
classic?
Well,
they always say they're going to make a lot of money. It's a horror movie.
It's
they
a horror
make
film.
A ton of money. That's always
if you get into this
promoted.
For money,
that's
you are the biggest idiot.
Yeah, but we could tell with you because you're also so smart. Just in speaking with you, you know how things run.
This
I mean,
is really
it's
uncomfortable.
No, it's true.
I think you're okay.
You know what? I think the thing with me is that I very much wear my heart on my sleeve, so I'm just very easy to
that.
Read.
That's why
like
not
I'm
here
not
today.
That's
yeah.
why.
Oh, that's right. I left them in the car. Which I know some people have actually found disappointing in the beginning because people didn't know until Holliston came out. Most people really, unless you watched the behind the scenes, you didn't know what I looked like. But you see the movies, like the Hatchet movies, and then you meet me and I've got the Yorkie and I'm just not what they expect. You know, well, I don't have any tattoos. I'm only 5'8". Like I look like a little kid. And so there was one dude who was like admittedly disappointed. He was like, really? He's like,
you were a black metal.
He's like, you made this?
I just said this before we started the podcast. Every convention I'm at, I must look like the matchmaker. Ultimately, so many women come to my table and they're like, tell me what he's like. Oh my gosh, is he single? I really want to be set up with him. And they all know who they are, okay?
But I don't know why you're not hooking up your very good friends.
Well, yeah, I've been painfully single for 6 years. Like,
I have to make sure they're the right. I was the same way with you that I met you at a convention and I was terribly shy and afraid. And I tell everyone, it took me until Sunday to come running up over to your table. Hi, Adam. Oh my gosh, my name is Felicity Rose and I'm just a huge fan. I can't believe I'm meeting you. And I left and you sent me an email about a month later about Scary Sleepover. And I ran through my house for at least an hour screaming, oh my gosh, I'm going to be on Scary Sleepover.
Her neighbors were so pissed.
It's so
shut
hard.
Shut the fuck up. Shut up.
I thank you for the kind words. It's so hard to hear stuff because, like, especially now. I mean, like I said, like I'm an open book, and the people listening to the podcast know it. But like the battle with depression and anxiety, like just everything that happened to me in 2014, the divorce, Dave Brockie dying, Fearnet going under. I mean, Holliston was the only thing I ever really wanted to do, and to have it all taken away within 8 days of each other, like all of the worst things that can happen. Because I think if it had just been one, I probably would have handled it better. But I'm still in all that. I haven't fully recovered. I don't leave Aeriescope unless it's to go home and shower. Like, that's it. Like, I
mean, does anyone recover from like a mass amount of trauma at once? You know, it takes a long time.
And I really want kids. That's all I ever wanted in life.
You could borrow ours. Mine are kind of crappy.
I've had to go to therapy to start accepting that I'm not going to have kids because that was part of the depression.
You can have kids until they're like 90.
Yeah.
I know.
Hello. I mean,
it was healthier to start looking at it differently and being like, all right, well, maybe that just is not my lot in life. Like, that's just because it was the idea being that it was healthier to come to some sort of acceptance to be able to tolerate. Because that was so much of my depression was like when the divorce happened, it was like, I wasted my whole life. Like, I lost everything I wanted because I made such a mistake.
Do they necessarily have to be your own children? I mean, certainly that would be ideal, right? But would you definitely be open to dating a woman that
has kids?
I don't know.
It just depends on the person, or if they're ugly. I don't want to have ugly kids.
But I did always want to have my own kids. So now you're talking about dating younger.
But like even a woman who's in her 30s is a great, she's ready. I feel like that's when a woman really comes into her own and knows what she wants fully. 20s is more partying. 30s, she's ready. So I think that's a good.
Women in their 40s can have babies too. So,
yeah, but I mean, they first want to have a relationship, get to know one another.
Oh, you don't want to just get a baby just jump day one.
Don't just like go in and have the baby and that's it.
And that's the problem when you're dating 36, 37-year-old women. A lot of them, second date, they're like, okay, so what are we doing here? Like, are we doing this or are we not? Because I don't want you to waste my time.
It's hard. Yeah. But so now,
and I'm like, what's your last name?
The directing side of things, because that's like, got to be hard. Nonsense. Like, you know, it's hard to have a relationship being a director. It's hard to have a relationship being an actor or whatever. Are there any directors current that you guys have worked with that you watch that you are just in awe of? That I'm like, that's filmmaking. Like to me, I watch Mike Flanagan stuff, and I'm like,
oh my god,
that dude is a genius. He's our like Spielberg.
He's incredible.
He's really incredible. Incredible. And is that like re-inspiring to you? Is it make you feel like, oh man, I should step up my game? Do you feel like, I mean, because I think there's people like that that kind of relight a fire. Like when I watched his series, I was like reinvigorated for the genre, like holy shit, like there's
I think
cool
as a
stuff happening.
Fan, like if you love football, you can't not be just enamored with Tom Brady. Like the dude is incredible. So even if you're not a Patriots fan, if you're a fan of the sport, you can't not love watching what this man does. Mm-hmm. So I think from that regard, people like Flanagan, James Wan, it's just as a fan, I just love seeing it and I love seeing them succeed. I feel like when people will ask, how do you never get competitive or bitter or jealous? And it's like, I don't know anyone else who's trying to do exactly what I do. So I think that makes it a lot easier. Mm-hmm. If there was someone else who, like I'm not chasing open directing jobs and losing them to other people. And then maybe it would be different if I was, but I create my own stuff that I don't think there's too much else out there that's like it. I always wanted to have Aeriescope. I wanted to have my own production company. Like everything was so much bigger than what the average person is looking at. And I don't know anybody else who ever wanted to make a sitcom about their life that was also like about wanting to be a horror filmmaker and having horror icons do comedy. And
so you're saying there's like room for everybody to sort of do their own thing.
But if you're doing your own thing, it's a lot easier to not be constantly comparing yourself to somebody else's success.
What about you guys, like with anyone new or that you're working with currently that you're like, holy shit, I'm inspired by their work?
Someone I'm working with, I mean, as I said, I've worked with some great directors who I really love. Tommy Faircloth, I keep working with. We just did
Crinoline Head. I've knew him from 100 years ago.
I love him. He's so great. He's so creative. Everyone loves his work. Like I said, Thomas Churchill, Aaron Mento is great. We did a funny movie called Ugly Sweater Party. But it's like, you know, these people are just, they inspire me because they love what they do. I love people who are passionate. Right now, I've always loved Quentin Tarantino. We spoke about this yesterday. David Lynch is someone who I'm mesmerized by. I remember seeing like Mulholland Drive.
Did you watch the new Twin Peaks?
Yeah. I love everything he does. And I honestly, you know why? Because I leave. I still, and I love it. I know there's, you know, we could go get into a discussion about that, the good, the, but with his stuff, I'm always left to think about it. And that's,
and there's no one else like him.
Sure.
There's no one
like
him.
Like Tarantino, there is no one else like him. So
that's my number one choice. Would be work with Tarantino.
Maybe. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was so, and I loathe long movies because I just can't stay awake. I didn't stop smiling for that whole movie. I could have gone on for five more hours and I would have been like, it's, there's just something about him, and it's he's one of a kind. And I think that's what makes you set apart. But there's obviously, there's no fairness to this industry. Like, there's so many talented people that the world will never even see their work. Mm-hmm. I want to know, as actors, what is it like when you tried really hard and you brought everything you had, you probably did it for far below your rate. And then do you blame the filmmaker when the movie either doesn't turn out well, or nobody even knows that it came out and it wasn't marketed or promoted, or, because that's what happens to most movies.
Of everything.
It has to, like, be partly.
It's partly to blame. I feel filmmaker. Like, we've talked about this plenty on our show, is that, you know, I show up, if I know my lines and I hit my mark and I gave it my best, like, I've done my job. So if I look around and everybody else isn't prepared, then it's like, all right, that's on you. Now, but if, I mean, everybody outcome, came together though, and was prepared, and the outcome was that, oh, they just couldn't get a right distribution deal, that's timing often. That's timing. That's money to not having the right agent that, you know, or right publicist that gave them the right
but
door.
But that's still
open.
Ultimately the filmmaker's responsibility.
But yeah, most filmmakers are not going to know, especially on their first movie.
Or they're not equipped.
Like, I was horrified when I saw what was happening with Hatchet. It was like all of these festivals and awards and all these great reviews, and Anchor Bay was going to do nothing. They were just going to, it was just going to suddenly be out one day. And they're like, if you want to promote it, go for it. But we're not spending any money. And then to watch it make millions and millions and millions. I mean, obviously they don't report most of this stuff. They do everything they can to hide it. But even just Rent Track, back when there was Blockbuster and stuff, it did something like 8 million in rentals in the first 18 days. So just imagine what it's done worldwide, and what, like, it's, and I got zero.
I was going
to
say, nothing. Do you get anything?
No, I got nothing.
But what I was going to say,
and I never will.
It's incredibly hard for,
and when people say, like, oh, we're doing Hatchet 10. Oh, fucking cash in for Green. A cash in? Dude, I'm still in debt from doing the fourth one.
But you keep, it's, we always say,
people forget that I'm on it for a year and a half because I love it.
And you own it, and it's your property, and it's your merchandise, and it's your character, and it's your dude's tattoo on people's arms. Like, that is worth something.
Not financial. That's the sad part. Like, yes, there's, we can sell t-shirts, or we can, it does not amount to a whole hell of a lot. It really doesn't. And the one good thing about, like, physical merchandise is people can't steal it as easily. Mm-hmm. But it's, the game changed right as I was joining the playing field. Like, I don't know how else to put it, but like 2007, there was still home video. There was still Blockbuster. There was still all this stuff. And then in 2010, around when Frozen came out, streaming was starting, and it was so easy to steal a movie online at that point. And how do you ask somebody to invest in your project? All they want to know is, how do I get my money back? Mm-hmm. And if you're going to be honest, how do you, like, you can't guarantee a thing unless you have, you know, they have these lists of name actors, and it changes every other week, their foreign value or whatever it might be. But you can't promise that the movie's going to turn out incredible and everyone's going to like it. And it's going to just, it's like when people ask you to make them a viral video. Mm-hmm. Like, if out of all the Halloween shorts we did, if you had told me Jack Chop was the one that was going to, everyone was going to know that one, I never would have believed it. That was a throwaway. We made it in a couple hours because we were out of time that year. And then look, so you just, you don't know.
So you're saying, I mean, it's partially when people get like the success of a movie, is it talent? Is it luck? It's a bit of everything.
I'm just saying that for any aspiring director who's hearing this, just know that your job is only beginning when your movie has been acquired. Unless it's a huge studio movie and you're gonna get the $25, $50 million marketing machine behind it. Because an opening weekend or whatever, that's purchased by the studio. Mm-hmm. So if it's a indie movie that's going to come out through one of these smaller distributors, it is 100% on you. Wow. Yeah, they'll have like an in-house publicist and they'll be like, we got you an interview with, I don't want to insult any of the horror sites because they're great, but you know, with the go-to horror sites. Like, great, awesome. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. But what are you going to do to let people know this movie exists? And they're not going to spend money. So you have to do it. You got to do every convention you can. You've got to go to every screening that you can. You've got to be online. And it's hard, man, because when no one knows who you are yet. And that's the thing. It's like, I don't even know why I spend so much time worrying about something that's not necessarily my problem. Because I've been around for a long time. But my heart breaks for the newer filmmakers who are so talented and who made something so great and no one's ever going to fucking know. And what are they supposed to do? Like, I mean,
that's perfect advice, mm-hmm. though, is that, you know, your job doesn't end just because you handed it to a distributor and, mm-hmm. you know, that you can make this great thing, but it's still your job as the director, writer, producer, whatever, to follow it through. And I think mm-hmm. all of us do a really good job at following those movies through until they're sort of dead, right? Like, mm-hmm. we're
you
always
You guys are
promoting,
great that you go to conventions and you're like, out there talking about it.
Go to film festivals. And like, I mean, not you, but. We've all died in your movie, and so I think it's only fair that...
I did.
Oh, yeah, we all did. Died in an Adam
through
movie.
Through a fucking plane engine.
Yeah. Oh, shit, that's right. Oh, I stopped watching it before that point.
Of course
you
did.
I forgot what
she
happened
had
at
died.
The end.
She
I died,
watch
so I turned
any
it
longer.
Off. But since we've all died on an Adam Green movie, I think it's only fair that Adam Green die on our fucking show. So let's
okay.
kill Adam
that's
Green.
It.
Wait, it's all
Adam
here.
Green.
I thought I was going to meet a nice girl.
We are going to kill Adam Green.
Let me rewrite this step because that was weird.
Buried the hatchet in another episode of Casualty Friday. Catch us next time wherever you listen. We will be there. Thank you, Adam
We
Green.
Love you, Adam
Thank
Green.
Thank you so much for having me and for all your kind
Fangoria
words.
Fangoria Podcast Network.
Casualty Friday is a Fangoria Podcast Network original, hosted and produced by Tiffany Shepis, Felissa Rose, and Kane Hodder. Executive producers Dallas Saunier, Phil Nobile Jr., Matt Mangiarides, and Justin Martel. Produced by Natasha Pasetta. Associate producer Jessica Safa-Vamare. Art and design by Jason Koslerich. Sound recording and mixing by Ernesto Hurtado at Rebel Talk Network in Los Angeles. Music by John Brennan. For Fangoria, Brandon Wynardi, Rachel Wilson, Brandon Jones, Rob Galuzzo, James Wallace, Monique Jacques, and Anthony Bonds.